This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Coming up, Rachel Maddow talks about her life, her career, and facing opponents as the host of MSNBC's top-rated show. But first, we're going to listen to Terry's interview with Matthew Weiner, the creator of AMC's Mad Men, which returned last week after a 17-month hiatus. When the previous season of Mad Men ended, back in October 2010, Don Draper had just proposed to his new secretary, Megan, whom he hardly knew. In the new season, Don and Megan, recently married, are living in a beautifully furnished Manhattan high-rise. At the center of last week's season premiere was a surprise party that Megan threw at their home for Don's 40th birthday. During the party, Megan performed a seductive song and dance for Don in front of all of their guests. Don was furious, and the main reason gets to his complicated identity. As Megan apparently already knew, the name Don Draper is an alias. His real name is Dick Whitman. Draper is the name of a lieutenant under whom he served in the Korean War. After Lieutenant Draper was killed, Dick Whitman stole his papers and assumed his identity. Because Draper's tour of duty was nearly up, becoming Don Draper enabled Whitman to return quickly to the U.S. But he's had to keep up that charade ever since. Dick Whitman was born 6 months before Lieutenant Draper, so the Don Draper birthday party didn't fall on Whitman's real birthday. In this scene from the season premiere of Mad Men, the Draper's beautiful apartment is a mess after that surprise party. Don Draper is in bed, tired and angry, when Megan walks in.
I know why you're upset. You're 40.
I've been 40 for half a year.
When is that going to stop? Only you know that. This is your birthday now.
Fine. I don't like my birthday. I told you I never had it when I was growing up, and I've never wanted it since.
You never had a birthday. Didn't Betty ever throw you a party?
No, because I forbid it.
Why?
I don't need to be the center of attention.
You love attention. You twitched every time I talked to another person.
More people feel the way I do than the way you do.
Where's your research?
Fine. I'm 40. It's too late.
Aww. Nobody loves Dick Whitman. I love you. That's why I threw you a party.
I'm going to sleep. You can do what you want.
That's a scene from the new season of Mad Men. Matthew Weiner, welcome back to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming. So glad the show is back. I missed everybody.
I'm glad to hear that, Terry. It's great to be here.
So exactly how much time has elapsed for the characters since season four? What year are we in?
We are in June of 1966, and we went off the air the last time. Don's proposal was around Columbus Day of 1965.
Okay.
So that's October. I guess it's 7 months, 8 months.
So Don is starting a new life. We are all wondering, how is it going to turn out? How will this new marriage turn out? And at first, in the season premiere, it looked like they were happy. They have a beautiful home in Manhattan. But now it seems... It seems to me, anyways, that the marriage is largely built on sex and that she doesn't really understand who Don Draper is and who Dick Whitman is and how troubled he is by his double identity, how heavily that weighs on him. How did you come up with the idea?
It's great. It's great. I mean, that's the whole idea is for you to have those expectations. I do think that their marriage largely being based on sex. I mean, you know, she's 25 years old and he's 40. I don't think that that is necessarily, they've only been married for 6 months or so. I don't think that that's necessarily troubling at that point. I think that their relationship, does she understand it? I was hoping that the audience would hear her say, nobody loves Dick Whitman, and realize that she knows everything about him, and in a meta way, almost wonder like, well, what's the story going to be about?
Well, did I miss it when he told her, or did Was that
yes,
in the...
Yes, it was off screen.
That was off screen. Okay. Yeah, yes. I was wondering that.
Yeah.
But she still
but
doesn't
the idea,
seem to get
you know,
it.
I mean, so much
she doesn't...
The...
She still doesn't seem
you
to get...
You don't think she gets it?
No,
I, think
I don't.
Well, she's young, and part of the story is that she's young, and she's youthful, and she's less cynical than the people in the office, and Don is trying to delineate his private life and his work life, and she doesn't understand that because she's a more hopeful and open and youthful person. And for him to explain to her, like, you know, that white carpeting to me in the apartment, that was a symbol of, you know, the sort of purity of their relationship, whether it's sexual or whatever, that that is their life. And bringing the office into that life literally destroyed their apartment. So maybe she doesn't understand that, or maybe she has to teach him to be more open with people. I don't know.
Of course, they both work in the same office together, so the office is already in the apartment in some ways. But I'm wondering,
right,
how did you come up with the idea of a surprise 40th birthday party as the thing that was going to show weaknesses within their relationship, weaknesses within this new life that he's created?
Well, it's funny. I don't know that I'm necessarily showing the weaknesses. There's certainly conflict exposed. I wanted to just sort of show you what their relationship is like. And, you know, they do work together. And he does come in and say, hey, are you ready to go? And Peggy both is her boss. And also she knows she has Don's ear. So that's an awkward relationship. And he, you know, wants her to, you know, fool around in the office. And at the same time, she's theoretically doing a job. I wanted the audience to see what she has to navigate. And at the same time, tell them a little bit of who she is. Her speech to him right before he proposed to her when they're in California about, I don't care who you are, I care who you are now, is a really, to me, was him choosing this youthful outlook. And her throwing the surprise party, I mean, it's an old saw. It's one of the oldest stories in the world. And I even sort of call it out when Peggy says to her, didn't they have Lucy in Canada? The surprise party is a bad idea. But I love the idea that she would publicly, she's an extroverted person. She's the polar opposite of Betty Draper in terms of what she's willing to show of herself. And I love the idea that she would give him this exuberant, openly sexual, you know, exhibitionistic birthday present that a lot of people, whether they were embarrassed or not, would be so – there is a way that you could enjoy this. And that Don would say, I don't like that, and sort of smack her in the face in a weird way for even sharing herself with other people. And I thought that was sort of a great way to come into a little bit of what's different about them. And hopefully the most shocking thing that you hear in that episode is Don laying there on the floor and saying, I don't care about work. I care about you. So maybe this is the kind of happiness he's just having to school her on how he expects happiness to go.
The previous season, season 4, ended after Don proposed to Megan. And they're lying in bed together. And she looks really happy, and she's fast asleep, her head on his chest. He's awake, and his eyes are wide open. He's kind of staring up at the ceiling, and then he turns his head and stares out the window. And I have contemplated a long time the meaning of that scene.
I'm sorry that you had to contemplate it for so long.
That's right.
But no, it's – what did you think it is?
Well, I thought she's like sublimely happy, and he's thinking, what have I done? And I thought it was an echo of – the previous scene's finale, when Don's first wife, Betty, is on the plane with her husband-to-be heading to Reno, where she's going to get a divorce from Don so she could marry this new guy, Henry Francis. And she and he look so like, gosh, we have absolutely nothing to say to each other.
Yeah. You know what? People read into it, and it's part of what's so great. No, I'm not saying you're wrong, but people read into it. I mean, that trip on the plane, to me, I picked the moment to show, and I look at Henry and Betty and I see a very loyal and substantial man who is taking care of this woman who has another man's infant. And I always felt that that scene was very intimate to me, that they were sitting on that plane. Yeah, he's reading the book, but I mean, what are they going to be holding hands and kissing? And that's not Betty Draper. She's not, and it's not the period, and it's certainly not that guy. But I did want you to think that there was some ambiguity in Don's face at the end of the episode. You know, he had just come from seeing Betty, who had basically offered herself to him again. But what's exciting for me, and I cannot talk beyond this episode, is that there is an entirely new dynamic. And I love that it's being seen that the first episode of each season, this has been my experience, really starts to become the finale, in a way, of the season before. And there is a new story starting there. And when you get to the end of the season, you will see it all laid out, but it is not clear to you what is going on. And what is clear is it's a new dynamic. People are in different places. I think people understand that to some degree, Pete and Don have changed places in a way. Don is living in this apartment that we all hoped he would live in as soon as he was a swinging bachelor. I mean, it's an incredible place to live. And he has this young wife, and we are not pretending like they are the same age. And all of the clothing and the hair and everything that we production designed, everything has changed like 25 degrees from where it was. And I've worked very hard to show what I think is an increasing sense of relaxation in social codes, even for that part of the world, that class and those people that age. And you'll see that the language is becoming more modern, that the attitudes are becoming more modern, that people are sort of breaking a lot of the mores, whether they like it or not. And also because you know how old they are, they're changing. So when you come into that dynamic, what you hopefully will see is a setup of a bunch of problems. One of them is, one of the central problems of the season is going to be the relationship between Don and Megan. What's wrong with it? All I can say is, you know already. You've been told, but it's not what you think.
So when you ended season four, did you know what season five would look like? Did you know what Don Draper was thinking when he was staring out the window after proposing to Megan? Did you know what the complications arising this season would be? Or did you figure, I'll find that out later when I sit down to write?
I always try not to paint myself into a corner. And when I came in at the beginning of season four, I said, Don is going to have these two parallel relationships. We're going to bring this character in, you know, as a tiny part, as a receptionist. And she, the actress didn't even know it, is going to end up married to Don Draper. And, of course, I have a chance to pull the plug on this thing at any point during the season because it's not set in stone, even though that's what I said I'm going to do. And when I got there, I was like, this is exactly what I wanted. So I knew that the reason why no one had really told much of a story about a divorced man, and there really aren't a lot of them, it was really hard for me because I was worried, like, do people not tell this story because it's bad? Or is it exactly what I discovered to be true? Men that age, at that time and this time, don't stay single. And it's a very short period. So he needed to have that stake on the table and needed to find some stability in his life, whether it was Faye or Megan is a personal, that's Don to me. But I knew that he was going to marry this woman. I knew she was a lot younger. I knew that she was a representation of the next generation. I knew that he was looking for all of the pure, fresh start that comes with a person like her. And I knew that that would be part of the dynamic for the new season, yeah.
Don still seems very turned on by his new wife. And he asks her to open the blouse, her blouse, while they're in the office together. And she resists but does it and calls him a dirty old man. In a loving way.
Yes.
And
It's a game, obviously.
It's a game. And speaking of games, after she's angry because he was so angry about this surprise 40th birthday party, she goes home early from the office because she was really feeling kind of sick.
She was ridiculed for her. He was right, is what she experienced, is he told her not to do that in front of the office, and she went to that office, and not only did Don judge her at home, but they were making fun of her behind her back.
Right, because she did this very kind of sexy performance. She sang a song
yes.
with a band that she'd hired. It's like very sexy, and people were making fun of her because of it, and because they wanted her, too. And they also dirtied her rug, her beautiful white rug, and so on. But anyway, so she goes home early, and then Don comes home, and she's really angry, and she takes off her clothes and strips down to her like sexy black underwear, turns her back to him, and starts cleaning up the rug in a very sexy pose.
Yes.
Which he's obviously turned on by, and it's kind of clear that she's kind of doing this like sex game that they do, and that she's
I think she, yeah
that she's kind of like you know like the whole kind of the fantasy of the maid and the sexy maid outfit. Who
I think it's more like about the sort of you know you can just say it. I hear you skirting around it. It is a sadomasochistic
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. It's and a sadomasochistic experience. And you know what? Who knows what goes on in people's bedrooms, but this is the natural part of human behavior. And she is punishing him. And, well, I don't know what your conclusion that you're driving to, but you see afterwards everything's okay.
Oh, right. Okay. But the conclusion I was driving to is that this is a part of Don I have a feeling we're going to get to know more about, because in I think it was like two seasons ago, or maybe last season, I lose track of
It was the beginning of last season.
I lose track of time in my life, let alone Don Draper's life. But so he's having sex with a prostitute, and she's slapping him, and he seems to like it. And this seems a little connected to that, that he maybe does have this S&M thing going on that we'll be learning more and more about in subsequent episodes.
I'm not going to tell you what you're going to learn about, but it's certainly Don's relationship between and the women in his life's relationship between power and sex is very closely linked. And I think that it's part of the human experience. I think it's an animal thing. And I think it goes with, I don't know, maybe it's because I read The Balcony by Genet when I was in high school. But powerful men in particular seem to want to be controlled sexually. And then, for me, you're seeing something very private. And I do that a lot in the show, where you're getting to see things that people don't dramatize normally. And I can't pretend like it's old hat and that this is going on in everybody's bedroom. But I think what you're seeing is that they do have a vibrant sex life. And that she is controlling that part of it, and he likes it. And it's the way they fight. And it's kind of her saying to him, you want to be this way? Then, you know, guess what? You can't have this. And teasing him, and I think wanting him to realize that if he behaves badly, he's not going to get it. And at the same time, what I love about it and what I think is fresh is that this woman is not treated like she's not judged afterwards. It's very rare for a woman to express that kind of sexual confidence and control and not be the prostitute and not be and be somebody's wife and be in a relationship afterwards. And I think I am both at the same time sexualizing their relationship and also explaining her status in their relationship and hopefully showing that it's an expression of the good part of their relationship, that it's actually based on love. There's a real warm, kind, intimate scene afterwards of actual communication and openness that we haven't seen from Don before. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, but there's part of me that keeps wondering, like, say she wants to have a baby, say she gets pregnant and she can't be like this seductive wife,
right,
at least for a while. Does he have to go find a new wife after that?
Right. Right. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, if this is a big part of their relationship, you don't want to lose it. Would her becoming pregnant do that? That's something for you to worry about.
Right.
I think it's fun. It means I'm telling the story well, that people are spinning out what it is. And I love that they're trying to keep ahead of it. And if you guess it right, it's not going to upset me. But I'm not going to tell you. You're going to have to wait and see.
I love the way the character of Joni has grown over the years. She starts off just being the kind of like sexy, head secretary at the advertising agency, who's kind of dishy. And now she's become like much more intelligent and focused and independent. You know, she has a new baby. Her husband, who's in the military, is away from home. He's based, you know, someplace else. And she really wants to go back to work. She wants to be with people again. She wants to be working again. And she doesn't really understand her emotions, because that's not the gestalt of the time.
Right.
And
it still isn't. It still isn't. How many powerful women stop to have a baby because that's what they always wanted and because they want to have a family, and then they're at home with this baby and they're thinking like, God, I miss working. Doesn't that make you a bad mother? It doesn't, but that doesn't mean you don't feel that way. And then they go back to work, and the most common complaint you hear is, now I'm a bad mother and I'm bad at my job.
It's so hard to balance.
It's not easy. I mean, I love the idea of her being this sort of single mom. And I think we learn more about Joan's personal life in the first, 20 minutes of this episode than we've known the entire time we know her. And what you're seeing is someone who is in a very kind of modern quandary because we know how powerful Joan is. We know that her ambition has been confusing to her, because really all she ever said she wanted to do was get married to a doctor or a professional and have a big house and live in the country and be taken care of like a queen. And life has thrown a lot of other conflicts at her. So why should she feel bad about wanting to go back to the office and be important and have that status? And at the same time, she's, you know, being a mother is supposed to fulfill all that.
Now, I just recently learned, I should have figured that this out, that I didn't, that one of the actors in Mad Men is your son. And that's the character of,
yes,
of Glenn, who's played by your son, Martin Weiner. And he's like, yes, the neighbor son who had a crush on Don's first wife, Betty, and he actually accidentally walked into her when she was in the bathroom and was just kind of
Not accidentally.
Okay. Yeah.
He went in there to see her. He went in there to see her, and that's why he stood there, and she had to chase him out.
And he really had a crush on her. And
oh yeah,
I think a lot of people, including me, see him as a smart but kind of creepy character. And then
the word creepy comes up a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And then he befriends Betty and Don's daughter Sally, and Betty's very upset about that because she feels like this kid's a little weird, and he doesn't want him hanging around Sally, and maybe she's a little jealous of the attention too, because
she
was very lonely at the point when he had the crush on her. But you know, he's a little destructive. He's kind of unpredictable and weird. You know, when Sally says that she doesn't really like living at home, things are bad, he comes in and turns the house upside down, with the exception of Sally's room. So why did you want your son to be playing such a role?
I thought we were
going to
talk
like
about the story. You know what? He was cast because he was the best person available for the role. I would have never thought of him if he wasn't my son, and it was actually someone else's idea. And I was actually counseled against it because of, you know, all the complications that can happen from him failing at that job. But he really nailed it, and he's a really good actor. And
did he want to act? Was that his ambition?
I don't know if he'd ever thought about it, but when I asked him if he wanted to do this, he wanted to do this. I mean, you know, it's very sweet. I mean, he's now 15, but at the time, I remember someone saying to him, you know, what's your favorite part about acting and he said eating lunch with my dad. So I mean, who knows if he even understands the difference between this job and other jobs, but it's beautiful to have him there, and I work a lot, and he is part of the cast, and the reason I had him play it is because he was good at it. The fact that I identify a lot with Glenn was confusing to him when he said, you know, he like a lot of actors, a lot like Kiernan, he can easily separate between himself and the character. Whether the public wants to separate him or not is going to be his problem, but he can. I feel like he's not creepy. I feel like this is an admission of unpleasant realities of the experience of childhood, which is that children are sexual, children are obsessive, they have almost all the same emotions and feelings that adults do, but they are children. And the thing that becomes creepy to me is that Betty is incapable of treating him like a child. And that is a peculiar relationship, but he's a little bit old for his age and she's a little bit young for her age. And I think the scene at the end of the first season when he sees her, you know, in the parking lot is one of the most touching things that we've done on the show, because he just says, I wish I could take care of you. I wish I could be your boyfriend. He even comes back the next season. He says, I have money. I know your marriage is falling apart. We can run away together. I mean, that idea. And now that he has transferred his interest to Sally, but to me, he and Sally's relationship is that he is a spirit guide. He has been there before. There aren't that many kids that have divorced families. He, like Sally, he's known her for a long time. There's very little stability in his life. And I think he is there, and I think it's a true friendship. And both of them need it really badly.
So how did you say to your son, how did you explain to him that he was going to walk that he was going to eavesdrop on Betty while she was in the bathroom? How do you explain that?
I told him that, you know, you walk in on her in the bathroom and you get caught. He just did it, you know. He read the script and he got it. He knew it wasn't him. I did tell him eventually that I had done this.
Oh.
And he said, Daddy, you're weird. you know, you can say whatever you want, but being a 9 or 10-year-old boy and seeing adult women, at least I have not met a man yet who has not shared this experience of already having feelings even if you don't understand them, you don't know how the mechanics work, but having very strong romantic and sexual feelings for adults. And it's part of childhood, and it should remain in childhood, but it is not some fairy tale world of innocence where adult feelings don't exist. And that's something that I think is a great point of entry for the audience. We've done it with Sally and with Glenn, and even with Don's childhood, seeing that adulthood is confusing. And it's actually kind of a theme on the show, is how you perceive adulthood. It's still confusing to Pete Campbell, you know?
were there consequences that you faced for walking into
a tremendous amount of shame. Uh-huh. Tremendous amount of shame, and trying to pretend like it was an accident when it wasn't. And our babysitter was, you know, I don't know what they call it, imprinting or anything. I just remember.
So it was the babysitter?
It was a babysitter, yeah. It was not somebody's mom. It was somebody, she was about 18. Mm.
So one final question. When Megan throws the surprise 40th birthday party for Don Draper, she surprises him even further by doing this very sexy song and dance number. And the song is a French song, and it's called Zooby Zooby Zoo. And I thought, where did you get this song from? Of all the songs in the world, how did you end up choosing this song?
I have a fascination with French culture from this period. It's all over the show.
Joni sang a song in French.
Yes, she did. She did. And hers is a little older than that, but this is one of those French novelty songs that just reeks of, like, it's like Bye Bye Birdie to me. It's one of these things where there's a little girl quality to it, and it's kind of childlike, but it makes it even dirtier when someone's behaving that way with it. I found the song. It was so catchy, and it's a little kiss, which is the title of the episode. And I just thought, here's Megan. She's going to come out and give Don this innocent song with this really, really striptease, you know, performance. And we're going to know that she wants to declare to the world that they are in love and super hot for each other. And Don's going to say, please keep that to yourself. I mean, for me, it's part of its showmanship that we did the number. And Jennifer Getzinger, who directed the episode, did an amazing job. She also directed The Suitcase. But Jessica, I mean, the performance of this song, and it's not easy to do what she did. And there's a story being told during the song, and they did a great job. But that was for the audience, and it was – some of it's just, you know, it's a little bit of a French movie for the audience, whether they've seen it or not. It's a little bit of little Dolce Vita in there too. And just the new aesthetic and the new dynamic. And I know it's a crazy song. I don't know how to explain it, but I played it once for the writer's room and people were humming it all day. And I'm like, I think I found something.
So there's this season plus two more seasons left of Mad Men. You've committed to a total of 7 seasons. Are you already thinking ahead to the final very conclusion?
I really had just an inkling, but during this experience of launching the show this season, I think that I'm getting a message from the audience that I better start thinking about it. I just use the story that I have. I just finished episode 13 of season 5. I am
That's the final episode, right?
Yeah, I'm creatively tapped out. There are 26 to do after that, and I'm going to take them one at a time. But yeah, I mean, it's imminent, I guess. I can be talked into doing more. We'll see. I mean, I think that's the perfect length for the show, and I'm looking at other shows that I admire and saying, like, let's not overstay our welcome.
Matthew Weiner speaking with Terry Gross. You'll find a longer version of their conversation, as well as an archived interview with John Hamm, Mad Men's Don Draper, online at freshair.npr.org.
Un, deux, trois, quatre.
Coming up after the break, Rachel Maddow. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Zooby, zooby, zoo. Mon Dieu, qu'ils sont doux. Zoubi, zoubi, zou. Zoubi, zoubi, zou. Zoubi, zoubi, zou. Zoubi, zou. Zoubi, zou. Le bruit des bisous.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Now we're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with Rachel Maddow, the host of MSNBC's top-rated show. Each weekday night, Maddow talks about stories in the news and important issues that she thinks most of the media have underplayed or overlooked. One example of such an issue is the pending bill in Uganda that Maddow calls the Kill the Gays Bill. One of the people Maddow interviewed about that bill is Richard Cohen, author of the book Coming Out Straight, Understanding and Healing Homosexuality. Let's begin with a clip from that interview. As a guest on Maddow's show, Cohen said that he doesn't support the Ugandan bill and that he is all about helping people who have unwanted homosexual feelings. Cohen claimed that he's helped thousands of people around the world come out of homosexuality. Maddow kept trying to explain that Cohen was being complicit with the Ugandan bill. Cohen tried to tell Maddow that he disagrees.
How could they punish it? It's just incomprehensible. That they would, as you have said over the last few days in this bill, that they would want to incarcerate or to criminally punish these men and women. We are totally against that. We are for your right and anyone's right to live a homosexual life, and we're for the rights of those who seek change and want to come out
straight. Let me try to make it more comprehensible to you. The legislator who sponsored the bill told the Associated Press today that he insists these strict measures, which I know you abhor, but these strict measures they're proposing, including execution, are necessary in their country to stop homosexuals from recruiting school children. Yeah. Let me also just read to you from your book, okay? Page 49. Homosexuals are at least 12 times more likely to molest children than heterosexuals. Homosexual teachers are at least 7 times more likely to molest a pupil. Homosexual teachers are estimated to have committed at least 25% of pupil molestation. 40% of molestation assaults were made by those who engage in homosexuality. This is the claim that you make in your book that exactly feeds these folks who want to execute people for being gay what they need in order to justify that. Right. Do you stand by what you said in your book?
Actually, you know that one particular quote, when I do republish it, reprint it, we will extract that from it because we don't want such things to be used against homosexual persons.
That quote is cited, you cite somebody named Paul Cameron as the source of that book. Paul Cameron has been kicked out of the American Psychological Association and the Nebraska Psychological Association and the Canadian Psychological Association, and then he tried to make himself a sociologist. Right. He got kicked out of the American Sociological Association. This is, I know that you say you're not going to include it in edition 3. I'm reading from the second edition here.
Right.
But this is made up, fake authoritative stuff that in other countries is being taken as science and used to justify, quite literally, killing gay people. Do you see now why you're being used in a political context here?
Okay, that's Rachel Maddow interviewing Richard Cohen. It's very interesting to hear how you handle that. And when I hear you do an interview like that, especially with somebody like Richard Cohen, who thinks that homosexuality can be, quote, healed, and of course, like, you're gay, I keep wondering, what goes through your mind when you talk to somebody who really believes that you could be healed and probably that he's the guy who could heal you?
It's, you know, listening to that, I don't think I've listened to that since I did that interview, and my blood pressure went up by about 30% just hearing it. I don't know how anybody watches my show. It's so tense. It's at least in moments like that. I ended up interviewing actually the sponsor of the Kill the Gays bill in Uganda himself later on. And I was asked the same thing, you know, is it scary to you to talk to somebody who wants to kill you for being gay? Well, no, because I'm not in a vulnerable position and I don't think they're going to. But in a case like that, to have somebody disavowing the reason why they're talking to me in the first place, their complicity in this thing that they're denying any responsibility for, it doesn't bother me as a gay person. It bothers me as a rational human being. It bothers me as somebody who wants accountability and who is grossed out by people who shirk their responsibility for stuff they've done.
Well, you talked to him about how he's using fake authoritative stuff. And I think finding fake authoritative stuff is one of the things that you really excel at. When people are offering themselves as experts, but the information that their expertise is based on is just wrong. You're very good on your show about finding the actual facts out and challenging the fake authority's credibility.
Thank you. I I think this is a contested area in terms of not just the way the media has diversified over the last couple of decades, but in terms of how we argue with one another. People who disagree on important issues don't agree on the facts. It used to be, I think, that we agreed on the basic facts that we were fighting over and we had different opinions about them. Now I think we accept different sources of authority. And so, you know, you just heard in the clip there, I was talking about Paul Cameron, who's this anti-gay activist who's tried to appear to be an expert in the field. As he gets kicked out of every professional association in the field, he just moves on to new ones, hoping that somebody will give him their imprimatur of their expertise. And eventually, I'm sure he'll, if he hasn't already, he'll make up his own professional association and say that he's captain and president of it. People can establish credibility and authority on their own say-so as long as nobody follows the trail and calls them out on it.
At the end of interviews, including one with Richard Cohn, you sometimes wish the person personal good luck, not professional good luck, because you disagree with their position, but personal good luck. Why do you go out of your way to do that?
You know, I feel like I am the host of my show in a couple different ways. Not only am I the person sitting there talking, but I am hosting people on the show as guests who I am implicitly telling my audience are worth listening to. And so it's counterproductive, I think, in terms of my relationship with my audience, for me to bring somebody onto the show and then say, you're not worth listening to, or you're a waste of space, or I wish you didn't exist. If I've brought somebody into the discussion, it's because I believe they are worth hearing. Not necessarily because they always agree with me, but because they have something to say that's going to advance our understanding of this thing that I've been trying to explain on TV. And so I am thankful for anybody who agrees to come on the show. And I don't think personal animosity ever really enters into it, even when I vehemently disagree with somebody. And particularly for people who disagree with me, I want them to feel like they have been treated fairly, like they haven't been ambushed. They weren't interrupted. They had a chance to say their piece. And even if they don't feel like they came out looking great because the host disagreed with them or they lost the argument or whatever it was, I don't want them to feel like it was an uncivil experience.
So there's just one question I want to ask you about your relationship with your partner, and that's about your first date, which I read was at an NRA Ladies' Day on the Range event. And I thought, like, was that supposed to be ironic? Because I can't imagine Rachel Maddow on a date at an NRA event.
I'm actually kind of a good shot. My partner, Susan, her sister is a lifetime NRA member and a real gun enthusiast. And when Susan and I first met and I wanted to take her out on a date, she said, well, I'm doing this thing to support my sister at her club. I thought, at her club? You're not really like a country club type person. What kind of, like some sort of dining club? What is this? No, her rod and gun club. And I said, sure. And so it was Ladies' Day on the Range. It was an NRA event. And the idea was to make the various shooting sports more fun for the ladies. And so Susan and I turned up. It was the best possible first date in the entire world. Turns out she was really good with the shotgun and I was really good with the AR-15. And, you know, despite my gun politics, I'm perfectly happy with shooting at a gun club and then leaving the weapons there and driving home. So it worked great. It worked great. And I think Susan's sister was given a lot of, gun club credit for having brought in some newbie liberals.
You know, one of the things that's interesting about this is I assume that you oppose a lot of the NRA's politics surrounding gun control, but you enjoy being at a shooting range. You're close to people who are members of the NRA. So does that make it easier for you to see the people who are opposed to you politically as also being people who, other than this issue, you might really like a lot, you might be close to, you might be related to?
Yeah, I don't believe that people who disagree in American politics are all that different from one another as humans. I mean, for the one thing, something that brings us together, no matter how much we disagree on a political issue, is that we both care about a political issue. And that's not true of every American. I mean, a lot of Americans don't care about politics much at all. And so for those of us who are engaged in the political dialogue in the country, we already have something in common if we care enough to disagree with each other. And so I like that. I like people who care enough to have an opinion. And, you know, when it comes to something like the NRA, I have a lot of respect for what the NRA used to focus on and still in part focuses on, which is promoting, you know, marksmanship and shooting sports and conservation. You know, I think all of that stuff makes a lot of sense. I greatly disagree with their efforts to radically liberalize gun policies across the country, and I think it's done the country a lot of harm. But I would hope that we could argue about that from a position of mutual respect. It's the way that we make smarter policy in the country, but it's also the way that those of us who care about politics can have good lives. Like, you don't need to spend all your time, you know, angry and full of hate about the people who disagree with you. You can like them and enjoy the fight, and I enjoy the fight.
So you got into broadcasting through a contest. I've read about this, but I still don't get exactly what was the contest and what did you submit that that enabled you to win?
Well, I submitted myself. I was living in Western Massachusetts, crashing with friends, working on my doctoral dissertation, and they said essentially that I could crash with them and not pay rent in exchange for me helping out around the house and sort of being a really underqualified handy woman. And my friends who I was living with listened to the local morning zoo radio show. And on the local morning zoo radio show, the news girl was quitting. And so they held an open on-air audition as a contest for somebody to replace the news girl. So I'm not a morning person. So the first tier of it was that I had to call in. And so I stayed up all night because I can't get up early in the morning. And I called in and then they asked me, and I passed that round. And then they asked me to come in and just rip and read some AP copy Newswire stuff. And I did it. And I remember the host said to me, "What have you been doing as your job?" And I said, "I've been unloading trucks." And he said, "From what?" And I said, "Bigger trucks." And they said, "You're hired." So it's like I got the joke and I could read. And so they hired me on the spot and I started the next day. And that was my first job in radio.
You did a Vanity Fair Q&A. And in answer to the question, "What is it that you most dislike?" you said infection. And in answer to the question, "How would you like to die?" which is, I can't say I've ever asked that to anybody, I don't think. But in answer to the question, "How would you like to die?" you said, "Reluctantly, I'm depressive." So two things really surprised me about those answers. One is I think of you as a pretty healthy person. So the infection answer to "What is it you most dislike?" surprised me. And I'd never think of you as being depressive. You have so much energy on the show and you just seem to have such like drive and kind of joy in the act of engaging in American politics. And you seem to really like enjoy having the show. I'm not saying it's not bone grinding, but but that there's something really exhilarating about it for you. And I've never thought of you as depressive.
You know, I love my job and I love politics. I felt like when I got my job at MSNBC, like I had won the job lottery, and 3.5 years, whatever it is later, I still feel like I've won the job lottery. And I think part of that is thinking, oh, it's going to go away at any moment. People are going to realize that I'm a great fraud and it'll end. So I better make sure this is a good show because it'll be my last. Part of me feels that way every day. But yeah, you know, ever since puberty, ever since I was 11 or 12, I guess, I've had cyclical depression. That's, you know, something that has been a defining feature of my life as an adult. And it's manageable, but it's real and doesn't take away from my joy in my work or my energy. But coping with depression is something that is part of the everyday way that I live and have lived as long as I can remember.
Does the focus that you need and the adrenaline surge that you get doing your show help with depression when you have it?
No. Depression for me is you can't distract your way out of it. And I think people can understand the difference. If you've never been depressed, you can still understand the difference between sadness and depression. It's like the opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference. And the opposite of happiness isn't necessarily sadness, it's disconnection. And you know, when you are depressed, it's like the rest of the world is the mothership and you're out there on a little pod and your line gets cut and you just don't connect with anything and you sort of disappear. And so it's not something you can, I think, talk therapy out of. I know some people approach it that way. For me, it doesn't work that way. It really is kind of a chemical thing. And yeah, you get some adrenaline from the work, but adrenaline isn't a cure.
So now let me get to something far more trivial, but nevertheless kind of fascinating, which is your look for TV. There's like two Rachel, there's two like TV Rachel Maddows. There's the one in your show who has like eye makeup and contact lenses and like a suit jacket. And then there's the one on the late night shows, like if you're on Jon Stewart or Letterman in one of their shows. And then you're wearing your glasses and you're not wearing, and your hair is like kind of, you know, messier and more casual. And you're wearing jeans, your clothing is more casual. So why can't you look like the late night Rachel Maddow on your show?
The secret is that I am the late night Rachel Maddow from the waist down every night on my show.
So you're wearing sneakers and jeans.
I'm always wearing
behind
sneakers
the
and like
desk.
Enormous 501s and like, you know, socks with chickens on them. it's my idea about what I should look like on television is that essentially I don't want you to notice what I look like on television. I have this basic idea that what I am proud of, what I'm trying to accomplish every night on TV, is based entirely on how good my argument is and how good the interview is and how well I say what I intend to say. And so that's what I focus on all day long. So I try as much as possible for the TV primetime cable equivalent of the orange prison jumpsuit. it's just I don't want it to be, or maybe the Catholic school uniform. You know, I want it to be essentially respectful, neutral, not distracting. If I could wear the same thing every day without that becoming a story, I would do that. And so I essentially wear a variation on the same thing every day, mostly to create kind of a neutral visual experience.
So how hard has it been for you to get used to being like a public person, like an outspoken and out public person? So I know if you put on your glasses, maybe people don't recognize you, but I'm sure a lot of people recognize you anyways, especially since you often appear with glasses on late night TV.
You know, it's an honor and a privilege to do what I do. I don't get energy from people recognizing me and talking to me as a person who they know from the media. But it's certainly not a negative, and it makes me feel lucky to have this job, and it goes along with it. I mean, if I could do my show, you know, in cartoon form where I didn't have to physically appear, I might enjoy that more because then I could have a more private life. But that's not the way it works. And overall, I'm so happy to be able to do what I do that it's nice when people know who I am because of it. And I try not to make it change my life too much. I'm trying to stay the same person I've always been.
Rachel Maddow is the host of MSNBC's The Rachel Maddow Show. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for online media, Melody Kramer, is responsible for Fresh Air's website. That's where you'll find a much longer version of the interview Terry Gross recorded with Rachel Maddow. That version includes talk about Maddow's new book, Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power. That's online at freshair.npr.org. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley. This is Fresh Air Weekend.